You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orhan Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Hello, Book Talk Today family, and welcome back to another episode of the Book Talk Today podcast. My name is Orhan, I am your host, and in today's episode, we are joined by Wendy Seifert. Wendy is a Melbourne-based writer, editor, and author. And in today's podcast, we discuss elements from her book, The Sunny Nihilist, How a Meaningless Life Can Make You Truly Happy. I know it's a very dichotomous title, but in our conversation, we discussed nihilism and what Wendy terms sunny nihilism, which is something that she has come up with and the premise of this book. So we discussed what nihilism is, some of the potential downfalls of nihilism, but how we can derive meaning from this life. There are people out there, me included, that like to derive meaning in everything that I do. But there are also others out there that don't tend to derive meaning from everything because it seems to not have such a beneficial impact on them. So in this podcast, we discussed nihilism, we discussed sunny nihilism, we discussed nihilism meme culture, but also what some of the perils of what happens when you attribute too much meaning to your life as well. So it was an interesting discussion, and there was much to be learnt and also much to think about as well. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the podcast, whether you listen to it on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple, and also leave a rating as well to help the rankings. Without further ado, here is the podcast with Wendy. Wendy, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And the topic of nihilism is an interesting one for me because I first came across it when I was at university and I was reading about philosophy. And I thought to myself, we all have this intrinsic idea as a kid about, you know, what is meaning? Why are we doing this? Especially when our parents are telling us off, we're like, what's the point of all this? And when I first came across the definition of nihilism, I thought to myself, this is an interesting perspective. But then I thought to myself, oh, it can get quite dark very quickly if you don't understand it well. So it was an interesting book, The Sunny Nihilism, your book, and I think it gives a fresh new perspective. I think a great place to start, Wendy, is discussing your journey to writing Sunny Nihilism, and also within that, just defining what nihilism is for those that perhaps don't know it.
For sure. I think you had probably a pretty classic introduction to nihilism, discovering it in uni. I love that you immediately kind of associated it with kind of these questions we ask ourselves as kids, because I think it's something that I sort of talk about a little bit in the book. And I don't think people always think of kids as like philosophical creatures, but I think in a lot of ways they are so like clear-eyed and insightful, not to be too kind of daydreamy about little kids. But I would kind of had probably a similar experience to you, where I'd come across it in a university setting. You know, you do a couple of philosophy courses, it kind of seems like a huge bummer, and you generally feel like it's something you should stay away from because everyone on the internet who's interested in nihilism seems like they're about to burn their parents' house down. So that was kind of my experience with it. I guess I kind of came to it in a little bit of a backwards way, where I sort of was in a bit of a tailspin, which I spend a lot of the book talking about, and I think a lot of people can probably relate to. I was kind of coming to the end of my 20s, really burnt out from work, sort of didn't really have anything like catastrophically going wrong in my life, but was feeling pretty lost and unhappy, and kind of I couldn't really work out what was wrong with me, because in theory I was kind of following all the rules and I was doing everything right, and I was, you know, eating my birch and muesli for breakfast and like having meaningful conversations and reading all the books you're supposed to read and like having a job that was doing all the bits and pieces that was supposed to happen, and I still just felt so overwhelmed and so stressed out. And I kind of was getting to this breaking point where, I mean, I kind of have this story I tell in the book where I'm pretty much having an anxiety attack on the side of the road, and I just feel so overwhelmed by my whole life. And I had this moment of clarity where I was just like, oh my God, like actually just like, who cares about any of this stuff? I'm just going to be dead one day, and all this stuff that I'm so invested in is so pointless. No one cares about it, and I don't even know why I care about it, and I don't even understand. I couldn't even explain to myself where like my motivation for doing any of these things were coming from. I was just so trapped in like the pressure of feeling like I was supposed to be doing them. And again, I think that when you kind of explain it, seems like the beginning of a total nervous breakdown, but I kind of had the opposite effect where I just felt so much better, so liberated, this kind of like thought that maybe nothing actually matters and I didn't matter and all my bullshit didn't matter, kind of just completely released something inside me. And obviously I didn't have my panic attack. I went home, continued on with my life. But I started thinking about this idea of like what meaning means to me and what it kind of has promised me and what it's delivered. And I think that led me to loop back to nihilism and probably approach it with a bit of a different perspective. I think I didn't go in there looking for destruction. I went in there looking for something that could maybe explain this epiphany I'd had. And obviously I spent a lot of time talking to people about nihilism. And one thing I've kind of really come to believe is with any philosophy, really, I do think, you know, you kind of get out what you get in when it comes to it. And if you go to nihilism looking for an excuse to completely combust, you will find it, as you will find in most things. But I think if you come with it with this kind of like almost sense of mindfulness and like peaceful empty-headedness, I think it can also deliver that.
And can you just quickly define what nihilism is?
Yeah, of course. So at its kind of most basic, the sexy sell for it is that life is meaningless. It's that everything is...
Tagline.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it says on the motivational poster. It's kind of that meaning inherently doesn't exist. It's something that we have kind of like constructed ourselves, that we have placed onto things. I often think of it as, it's not like a force in the universe, like gravity, that, you know, everything has to have a point. It's just that the world is chaos. It exists just because it exists. And any kind of like perspective you place on that, whether that's a belief in God or in romantic love or political systems, you know, they may have value to you, but they are just constructs.
There's no objective truth. I think that's the idea. I think you mentioned Kant in the book that said something true. It's like nothing is inherently true because we all have our own definitions of it. And you also gave a disclaimer about him and his past as well, which I only found out about recently when I had Kehinde Andrews, who wrote a book on the Age of Empire, on colonialism. And I was like, oh, he wasn't a good person.
Oh, no. No one you liked before 1970 was a good person, pretty much. But that's so interesting what you're saying about truth. I actually had an interview with someone from a philosophy magazine, and we had this really lovely chat. And then at the end, she said something like, but how can you believe that? Like, then what is true or something? She had some question about like, but how does that stand against the idea of like truth? And I was just like, what is truth? What are you talking about? I was like, it's 2021. Who believes in truth anymore? Not to me. And it sounds like I'm from Red Scare, but.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, like my perspective is like, I'm religious and I've been brought up as a Muslim like my whole life. So when I read a book like this, I find it very interesting. Like I think it's very, you mentioned it in the book as well. You said that most young individuals now believe that people who are religious are more divisive than people who aren't, because they look at someone who doesn't fit into their viewpoint of how they see the world, and they automatically put them away or shun them away or do something else that is violent. And it's interesting for me because I read a book like this and I think to myself, well, your version of truth is different to my version of truth based on your experiences, based on your growing up with your family and your experiences, which you talk about in the book. So I think it's just interesting to come at it from a different perspective and see, yeah, well, there is a lot of things in life that are just completely meaningless. Like, why are we here? How did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, everything is kind of true to someone and nothing is true to everyone. The religious point is really interesting. I write about my mom a lot in the book, and she kind of, for large parts of it, it's almost kind of like a muse and a foil. And obviously inspired a lot of this book. My mom is religious and has completely different beliefs to all. Her idea of truth is the dead opposite to mine. But then it's interesting to me that these conversations we had when I was a kid were so seminal in like solidifying a belief system that is the kind of the dead opposite to hers, but also fits kind of neatly into it.
When you were discovering this sort of self philosophy, another philosophy that you've tried to just taken from or sort of passed from somewhere else, but we'll call it a self philosophy. What were some of the apprehensions, or what were some of your feelings you had when you had discovered this sense of sunny nihilism and you thought to yourself, oh, this fits in with how I'm feeling about the world? Whether it be how you construct your day-to-day life, how you see your job, etc.
It's interesting. I found it immediately very, it made a lot of sense to me. And it's something that when I was writing this book, I wrote it during COVID, during lockdown. And it was very much like writing in this like pretty interesting, like social and emotional bubble. And I had a few moments where I was like, what if I get out into the world and I don't think any of these things anymore? Like, what if a year passes and I change my mind and I've just like told all these people these things? I can report that I still very much believe in these things. I feel like it fit. It makes a lot of sense to me. Obviously, I wrote a book about it and I do find myself returning to it constantly, but I'm quite like careful to say, I am aware of that there is this irony that I wrote a book where I'm pretty much like, don't believe any dogma. Nothing is real. Everything is constructed. But I also wrote a book that is effectively, as you said, a belief system. Yeah. So sometimes when people ask me questions of like, well, how would a Sunny Nihilist approach this? I want to be like, don't listen. They would not listen to this in the first place. They would like throw the book out the window. So I think that I am quite cognizant of that dichotomy within myself. But then saying that, I think I use it as kind of like a tool to check myself within, because I didn't reach some sublime transcendence plane where I wrote this book and now I never feel anxiety or like have any negative emotions. But I do think it stands up as this kind of assistance where sometimes when I find myself spiraling, it's been several years since I had that realization, I'll stop and I'll say to myself, actually, who cares? Like, one day you'll be dead. And it still brings me a lot of relief.
And I think that brings you relief regardless of what sort of viewpoint you have on the world. Like we've said it, I've said it many times, that thing, because when you're doing something so menial, especially when a job, and you think to yourself, why am I getting stressed about this? Like, who cares? If they got rid of me, they would find someone else and they would forget about me within 3 days.
And I think that, you know, a lot of people have talked about in the past, you know, 150 years, we've become very like divorced by away from the idea of our own death and mortality. And we spend a lot of time trying to not think about it. But when you do think about it, I mean, it gives you a sense of preciousness that I think sometimes we lose. We were chatting before we came on about, you know, when you just spend your life just scrolling on your phone and you just have these moments, you're just like, wait, is this my life? Like, I have this finite amount of minutes and this is how I'm using them. I think that sort of like acknowledgement of death and meaninglessness and like this end and emptiness, once you move through the existential terror of that, it actually does give you this nice realization. And I mean, there's this form of meditation I write about called death meditation I discovered, where it's literally you take a breath and you tell yourself, this is my last breath. And then you just keep saying that to yourself continuously. And I mean, I don't meditate as much as I probably should, but I would encourage people to try it. At first, obviously, it feels insane. But after a while, it does give you this like crazy hyper awareness of your body and your surroundings, to the point that literally breathing out feels like the luckiest thing in the whole world, which I mean, it is.
It is. It is definitely that perspective shift. Probably don't start with death meditation if you're going to start with meditation.
Yeah, true. Work up.
It might be a bit of a roadblock there.
Listen to a Beatles album first.
It's interesting though, because my when I look at, for instance, coping mechanisms that individuals have, whether it be yoga retreats, sort of really, really specific diets, there's a new sort of sleep revolution happening, or whether it be meditation with these apps, I do believe it's a bit of a replacement for what individuals had found previously, but they're just using the coping mechanisms of the 21st century to replace it. And I know in the book you talk about, you know, why am I sort of looking at my phone to do meditation, or why am I looking at my phone to, you know, check my sleep cycles? Why am I just not sleeping? So do you think a lot of people place too much emphasis on that type of stuff instead of just doing what they need to do?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And, you know, I'm obviously very skeptical of meaning, but I also don't want to be dismissive about the fact that the pursuit of meaning and the belief in it has been like completely formative in, I mean, not just humanity, literally our brains evolved to like have these ideas. And I, as I said, I'm not religious, but I am very interested in religion and I have a lot of time. I like hearing people talk about it. There are times where I wish I was religious, to be honest. I feel like it seems like a nice thing to have in your life. But I do believe that as we have kind of lost, not everyone obviously, but a lot of people have lost that part of their lives, we have sought we've sought to fill it in different ways. And, you know, you used to maybe go to like church or synagogue or temple when you felt overwhelmed. And I'm very interested in like, well, what are the spaces that have replaced that? And as you said, sometimes that's meditation, sometimes that's yoga, sometimes that's extreme dieting. I think we are all chasing the same feeling of like, what am I here? How am I supposed to behave? What does a good life look like? We're asking the same questions. We're just asking them of different things now.
Yeah. Like I had this observation about Sam Harris, who has the app. I think I can't remember the name of this app, his meditation app. But he is sort of a staunch critic of religion and he's written many books on it. And I thought to myself, well, in the past, perhaps some of his followers might have gone to church or even some of them might have gone to the mosque and they might have paid for, I don't know, the like charity or whatever for their admission to that. And I think to myself, they've just replaced that with paying Sam Harris and a company to do a meditation app for them. And it's the same thing that someone, their ancestors two generations prior would have done, but they would have just paid like for a community and they're paying for that same community, but it's a digital community and they're getting an app instead.
Yeah, exactly. I 100% believe that. And I often think that when I see these kind of like communities spring up, you know, when you see people get obsessed with like SoulCycle or Peloton or whatever, yeah. And you're like, these places are modeled on churches. Like this is how people have learned to communicate. It's from going to church or seeing religious leaders speak. I think, you know, when I kind of think what I would hope people take away from this book, I don't expect everyone to put this book down and be like, I'm a nihilist forever. I don't believe in anything anymore. Obviously, most books you read, you probably actually walk away with like 10% of it that you apply to your life. Yeah. But I do think that if there was something I hope people absorb, it's this idea of you don't have to give up on like a quest for meaning or completely reject it. But I think that there is a lot to be achieved from doing what you've just explained. When someone presents you with like a new architecture of something that is meaningful, to just pause for a second and say, A, what am I trying to get out of this? Like, what am I actually trying to achieve here? Or what is this person kind of trying to get out of me? Because, I mean, there are a lot of systems of meaning. I think most people who meditate every day probably aren't having any toxic side effects from it. But I do think that this kind of like endless thirst for meaning and this desire to be told what to do and to be told that we're living correctly does make us vulnerable to exploitation.
So you believe that, I know you touched upon it in the book, do you think that it's those people who place meaning on people who try to derive meaning from every single thing that they do in their life?
Yeah, I think that sometimes we try and make every single thing meaningful because we kind of feel like every single part of our lives needs to be valuable. Whereas it doesn't. Like you're supposed to have empty time. You're supposed to have things you don't care about. You're supposed to have, I mean, the sense of emptiness, I think, is important. But also I think that's in a very personal sense. I spend quite a bit of time talking about work in the book. I'm very interested in kind of like modern work culture. You know, we've seen this kind of backlash against, you know, work as family, the girl boss cult, work as an identity. I think a lot of that is people coming and telling you that your job is meaningful, your place at work is meaningful, work is where you find identity and find community. Which again, in theory is great, but is very, very easy to then be exploited. And that's how you kind of end up working 16 hours a day for 30K a year or whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of individuals out there, I think, that are pushing that narrative where they're trying to attribute individuals to their jobs and try and convince them. It feels to me like convincing themselves that their job should be meaningful. As the employer, you said, okay, you should be finding meaning, but the employee is trying to search for meaning. And the employer's just like, no, there's no meaning here. You're just like Amazon. Like, what are they trying to give you? They're not trying to give you meaning. They're literally trying to suck everything out of you.
Or, I mean, I would say that's exactly what they're doing. But when you see Amazon talk about themselves, they're like, we're connecting the world. We're building these things. Like companies make these myths. Another like kind of weird pet interest of mine is like company values and like company mottos, the way companies talk about their missions and mission statements. And they're so mental. And like, they'll be talking about something where it's like, you know, we're connecting the world. We're creating all these things. And you're like, you're delivering like discount packaging and kind of exploiting minimum wage workers. Like, but everything has to have this kind of like meaningful sheen to it because we're kind of so obsessed with this like currency of meaning. I often talk about this kind of meaningless meaning. When you see it everywhere and it can become a bit of a game of like spotting it. I was in the supermarket the other day and there was a box of tampons and it said, there's a revolution in this box. And I literally was just like, what are you talking about? Like, there is something revolutionary about tampons, but I was like, I don't think that that's what you're selling to me right now. But it's just this insanity that everything has to have like this weird message.
I feel like that's the same with everything right now. Like whether it's a program, whether it's a movie, whether it's someone's social media page, whether it's a podcast like this one, everyone is trying to sell you their different definition of meaning and what consuming their product or service or whatever it might be will give you more meaning. And it's up to you then to consume it to gain some type of meaning. But do you think that
that's meaning, exactly it. It's not allowed to just be a product.
Yeah, but do you think that like meaning can only be acquired from an individual from within?
Yeah, so I obviously have my own feelings about meaning and what the quest for it looks like. As I say in the book, I have a lot of time and respect for people who are genuinely on like a quest to try and understand themselves and understand the world, whether that's through, again, a commitment to environmentalism or religion or civic life. The quest for meaning in its purest form, it's pretty hard to take fault with it. Like, even if you don't believe in it, a lot of good stuff comes out of it. I think the issue there is it's really hard and it takes a lot of time and it takes an incredible amount of pretty brutal self-reflection that is often very unpleasant. So I think what people have caught onto and corporations and managers and, you know, all these forces in our lives are, if you can kind of offer someone a dupe of that feeling of kind of revelation and save them the 40 years of looking for it, it's a very attractive product. And I think that's why people are telling you that every box of tampons is a revolution, because they know that there's some like little trigger in your brain that wants to feel like every day you're kind of making a difference and you're doing a thing. But the actual act of maybe living your life in a way that reflects that is a lot of work. And also, like, for a lot of people, maybe impossible, because, you know, the world is hard and you have to get paid and get home and clean your house and feed your children. And maybe in the modern world, like, the space to have a very rich spiritual, philosophical life isn't really available to everyone.
That's an interesting perspective. Going back a bit, do you think that individuals right now are not being given the correct framework, or they're, for instance, the way I think about this, it's like you said, parents are so busy, communities are, then the community sort of dissipates to a degree because parents don't have time to perhaps go to community gatherings, and then their children sort of suffer because they're just at home on their iPad and they're just scrolling through and they just, I don't know, they're projected these ideas from corporations or cartoons. Like, I've watched cartoons the other day. My niece is like one, well, a bit more, she's like probably 16-18 months, and I started to watch like cartoons with her and I thought, these things are crazy. Like, I thought they'd just be like some nursery rhymes or something. They're like crazy. There's like cats and hippos doing weird dances, and it's a bit too suggestive for me. So do you think like the sort of the individuals and parents are way too busy, and that is contributing to perhaps these individuals over time and over a generation sort of moving away from constructed communities and moving more to, for instance, their own ideologies?
I don't know. I'm always kind of, maybe because I worked in youth media for a long time, so I always have a lot of affection for the modern world. I'm kind of always wary of explanations that say the old world is better, the new world is bad, because I think that every single generation thinks the one that comes next is cooked and is fucking it up. Like, true. You know, people hated the printing press, people hate TikTok. Yeah. When you talk about like kids shows are so crazy now, I mean, I was watching like Ren and Stimpy and Gummy Bears and like these like totally cracked, you know, 90s TV shows, which were probably as mental as anything on TV right now. I think for me, and I mean, I think all through history, people have been saying this, it's not about controlling the information that people are being given, because I think that's an impossible task and it's also a dangerous task. I think it's about helping people and encouraging people to interrogate why they're being told what they're being told and what kind of behavior people are trying to get out of them. And I mean, sometimes when I say that, it sounds a little bit like QAnon, like do your own research energy. I don't mean it like that. I think it's more we move through our lives, and I don't think we're always encouraged to kind of recognize the invisible systems of like power and control around us and how they work. So I think sometimes when I'm interested in these things in the sense of meaning, it's, as I said before, you don't have to reject every message someone gives you, but I think it's a pretty good habit to develop that when someone is trying to get you to behave a certain way or consume in a certain way or think in a certain way, obviously ask, does this thing make sense to me? Does it work for me? But also ask, what is this other person actually getting out of this exchange by me changing my behavior? And I mean, sometimes the answer is, you know, they're not getting anything out of it. They're just giving me good advice. So like, this actually makes sense. But as you kind of said, I mean, with that Sam Harris example, you know, people obviously have their own beliefs about Sam Harris. Yes, maybe this person's giving you the advice because they genuinely want to make you feel better, but also maybe they want to put another story on their house and, you know, they want you to buy their app.
I think I'm an inner cynic about all these types of things, because I feel like in Sam Harris's case, it's very much he sees that individuals are moving away from this way of thinking, and he's obviously a product of that, and he realized that there's a void. And he wanted to fill that void that he somewhat helped create. So, like, for me, it's a business move, but I know others are sort of diehard Sam Harris fans. But I think once you sort of take...
Yeah, exactly. And I'm always like, you know, what does Amy Poehler say? Good for you, not for me.
Yeah, like, exactly. Exactly.
Happiness and explosive.
The thing is like, I can also understand, and I'm not against him as an individual, but I can also understand there are going to be a subset of people who do find happiness or meaning or whatever you want to attribute, you know, to that. They will find some value in what he is saying and the app or whatever he does, or whatever someone like him, because it also falls on the other side for people who fall under a religious way of thinking. So it's difficult just to say that that's good, that's bad, and that's sort of case closed.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, in relation to my work, but also just my life, I am very skeptical of like any form of absolutism. And I said before, like, I sometimes find it kind of a struggle when I think about the fact that I wrote like a book that is in a sense an absolute text, because there's also part of me that's like, you really shouldn't completely listen to anything that anyone says.
I wouldn't say from reading your book that it's absolutism to that degree. And perhaps that is a different perspective, but I read it. I read a lot, and I read things with a very light touch. Because I think you need to understand, like, I always love figuring out what the author's background is, you know, what they do as a profession. You know, you talked about your family history, which is great in the book. A lot of writers don't do that. A lot of authors don't do that. So I think you have to read a book with that lens, or any information, whether it's a video, whether it's, you know, an interview, or you sort of you're sitting down with someone. You need to try and understand, you know, why they think the way they think, not what they gain from it as well, you know, because... Mm. The gain is sometimes society, sort of pushed from society, and it's not, they might not even be aware of it, but a lot of people sort of know or think a certain way due to their background.
I like that also as kind of like a companion statement to this thing we were chatting about before, when we were saying, you know, what is someone trying to get out of me when they're telling me this thing? I think the kind of cynical question is, what are they trying to get out of me? But maybe a constructive add-on to that is like, why does this person feel like this? Why does their world look like this and mine looks different? And I mean, I think we could all really benefit, obviously, in a very divisive society, to do that more.
Yeah, and that's why I feel like having conversations is really important, because then you try and get down to the crux of the commonalities. Because I read the book and I thought, yeah, I think a lot of these things. And for instance, someone like might see your title who is religious and might just be like, nope, I am going nowhere near that. But then I think once you peel back the layers a bit more and you sort of take yourself out of it, you kind of think to yourself, yeah, most people, I know many religious people that said, oh my God, like this is, sometimes it just feels like it's utterly meaningless.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this book is very much, we chatted before about like, I'm not sure if it was when we're on mic or not, these kind of questions that we ask ourselves as children. A lot of this book is questions I asked myself as a kid that were completely kind of spun from like going to church and like having these like religious conversations.
Where do you think the line is between sort of sunny nihilism and sort of coming to this idea that life is meaningless, but we can find joy and hope and feelings of sort of contentment, and that dark side of nihilism. Because I know you talked about QAnon and conspiracy theories and life is meaningless. And it becomes meaning is only important to me as the individual, and I will do anything in my power to make sure that the life that I have is meaningful, even if it means total destruction. So where's that fine line?
Yeah, I feel like that question is such a core part of the book, and it's something that I thought a lot about when I wrote it. And to be honest, I think about it a lot now, because sometimes I think, you know, why did I turn out like this and I didn't just become like a 4chan troll? And, you know, there is part of me that's like, you know, we all have different brains. Maybe I'm wired for kind of like a nice sense of optimism, but I can't really believe that it's all just lucky brain chemistry. I think that idea of the individual is really interesting. And I think something that kind of comes up when there are obviously a lot of things you have to consider when you consider nihilism. But I think there's kind of this choice you make where it's like whether you accept the dissolution of the self as like the center of all things, and whether you kind of see that as like, you accept that as like a positive thing or as a terrifying thing. And yes, there is an obvious terrifyingness of saying like you are meaningless. Like I think people's first instinct is to be afraid of that. But what I find interesting is if you kind of, again, don't like knee-jerk reaction fall into that fear and that despair, but you allow yourself to kind of like sit in that discomfort. And, you know, I talk a lot in the book about like the abyss. If you allow yourself to really gaze into the abyss, as Nietzsche like to say, there is a lot you can find there, because when you remove yourself from like your consideration of reality or the world or the planet or the future or the past, a lot of really interesting stuff fills that space. So for me, the question, and I think with a lot of people who maybe feel the same way, it sounds like you're kind of the same. If you sort of say like, okay, well, I don't matter, you take me out of it, you still have like a life to live and days to fill and things to do. So what then becomes kind of the preoccupation then, when you can kind of consider existence as being more than the 80 or so years you might be on the planet? And I think that's when you kind of get into this really interesting space where you say, well, what does actually matter then if it's not just my comfort and my ego and my like flash in a pan consciousness? I talk a lot in the book about environmentalism. I'm very interested in environmentalism in my own life. To me, the answer to that is, well, then it's just the protection of the planet. That's the thing that we all have to do. That's the thing that kind of is the continuum. Again, some people it's religion, some people it might be culture, some people it might be art and music and protecting these things, some people it might be protecting ideas like freedom of speech. But I think once you can kind of not be terrified by the idea that's not about you, and you can say, okay, well then what else comes up, it can be a far more holistic way to sort of live your life and actually see yourself, I suppose, connected through time. And I mean, it can sound a bit like hippy-dippy, but you know, I'm in Australia, I'm really interested in environmentalism, and a lot of that is kind of being pretty interested in like First Nations culture and First Nations approach to the way people kind of care for land. And I think that something that I really love about that is that it's this idea of you are just like on this, you are just part of this like endless expanse of time, and you're kind of just trying to do as little harm as possible. And I'm not trying to like simplify obviously a whole culture's experience of the world, but I think that this idea of connection of you're kind of just passing through and you're trying not to do damage, and you're just trying to like continue something on that is bigger than yourself, that is something that kind of comes out, which is to me is far more comforting than any idea I could have about my own life.
Yeah, like I like that perspective shift, but the issue I have is there's this narrative out there. I don't know whether it's just society in general. I don't know whether it's westernized, because I feel like it's westernized view. It's like your life is special, you are special, and you are here to make a dent in the universe, as Steve Jobs would like to say.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think that narrative gets pushed too much, and it becomes very much about, okay, I will do anything to make sure that I get my way. But then it's not so much the actions, but there's perspective, because then individuals think to myself, oh my God, I have this limited time to do all these things. How am I going to do it? And they go into like some existential angst and stress about, oh my God, I've got limited time, I need to do all these things, because most of the time, it's not because they want to do it. It's also like a narrative about this is what you have to do. And I think once you get out of this narrative that you have to do things, and questioning why you have to do them is I think a great perspective shift.
Yeah, I mean, you've literally, that's exactly where I was at the beginning of this book, like just feeling like you're kind of losing a race that you don't know why you started or who's like holding the timer.
Yeah, and I think it's deconstructing the society around you. And I think that's very interesting for me with my perspective, you know, growing up in the West, in the UK. But, you know, my family's very deep rooted, like I'm a third generation immigrant. So we still have very close ties to the culture of my grandparents. And when you sort of think about that, you think to yourself, oh, I'm living in this space where individuals, like my friends, very rarely share the same viewpoint, you know, spiritually and religiously and all that type of stuff. But we still have a lot in common, obviously, because you've grown up. And I think trying to deep root yourself and give space to that and be like, okay, I have these viewpoints. This is my family. This is my culture. But different people have different ways of thinking. And you sort of have to have some space, or like, I think in cognitive behavioral therapy, they call it like, I think, I can't remember the term, but it's like give space to your life. Like you're not the person living your life, but you're just an individual who is living, and you're just live.
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, that kind of gets back to what we were saying before, like this idea of when you try and make every single thing meaningful, it makes your life very noisy. Whereas like, I know I said before, I'm skeptical about when people talk about how the past used to be better than the present. One thing I would say is a criticism that I'll wear. I do think that you need like empty space. A friend of mine, when I kind of was recovering from like burnout and stuff, she said to me, you need to like allow yourself to be bored, and you're not going to like know that your brain is healing until you feel bored, because that's when you can actually like enjoy yourself. And I think that that is something that I think is super interesting. And I think a lot of this, you know, we said before, the quest for meaning is valuable, but it takes a long time. And I think when you try and short circuit it in all these different ways, what you rob yourself of is that space to actually really like think about these things and figure this stuff out and get, that's where the value is really lying, not in, you know, a good motivational poster or a good company value
or a podcast.
Yes, exactly.
Or anything like that. I do believe that. I think if you're looking for that in these things, I feel like it is, you get these sort of hits, like whether it's dopamine or whatever, you get these hits of feeling as if you're getting closer and closer. But I do believe it is empty to a degree.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's very human to, you know, again, I don't believe in any like core fundamentals of humanity, but if I was going to throw one out there, I think people just effectively want to be told that they're doing it right. And I think these things are kind of a way to feel like you're doing it right. As you said, I'm spending my time right. I'm living my life right. I'm kind of ticking the boxes I'm supposed to tick.
Yeah, I'm on the right path. I think people want to know that they're on the right path, whatever path that is. You know, it can be different for you and I, but they want to know that they're sort of on the right path, because otherwise,
yeah, exactly.
What's the point?
There is no point.
One thing I wanted to bring up with this idea that manifestation and affirmations is sort of rife in the self-development world. I have my own personal, I say hatred is a bit far, but I have my personal sort of questions around manifestation and affirmations and this type of stuff, because it almost feels as if the universe is there to reward you. For some reason, there's like some sort of debt that the universe owes you. And if you go and do these types of things, the universe owes you something. So do you feel like that is a very pernicious thing right now for individuals, because they feel like they're demanding something from the universe? You know, they're sort of saying these things, they're doing these things, they're saying these mantras, hoping for the universe to reward them, whatever that means.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't really thought about it like that before, but I guess it kind of gets back to what we were saying about, I think people are sort of looking for shortcuts for these feelings, and you sort of, when you do that, you massively flatten out these conversations that, I mean, as we're finding right now, like take, you know, an hour or so to have. People just want the kind of like single serve version of it. And again, I mean, I'm sympathetic to that. I think we're trying to stuff our lives full of so much stuff, so they feel so stuffed full, so they feel so busy, so that everything feels so urgent. You sort of just want a single line that will contextualize everything to you and make it make sense, that you can just read on your phone before you get out of bed. But I think in the same way that it takes kind of quite a lot of like bravery to like stare into the abyss or consider these things, it takes quite a lot of grit to allow yourself to like be comfortable with the mess of these things and to be confused and to not have an answer and to feel lost and to understand that that is actually the true human condition, is feeling completely out of control. Mm. And the fantasy that you'll ever be in control is really the sort of lie that's probably going to drive you crazy.
Yeah, definitely. I think an events happen to you that sometimes obviously aren't your doing that really change your perspective. You talked about burnout in the book, but I think death is of a family member is one of those things that really call into question meaning, because you think to yourself, wait, they were here 2 weeks ago and I was sort of sitting next to them and now they're not here. And you think to yourself, it's a bit weird when you think about it.
I often find when I've ever kind of lost someone or experienced, you know, a great tragedy or anything, I mean, even just like a bloody awful heartbreak, it's always really confronting when you kind of walk down the street and you look at all these people just living their lives and you're like, wow, like the biggest thing ever just happened to me. Something has completely transformed my life, my brain, my family, my history, and no one here knows about it. And it actually just is completely like totally meaningless with all this stuff. I find that, again, kind of super humbling, I guess, kind of confronting, kind of comforting. I remember one day in the early days of COVID, I was driving somewhere early in the morning and, you know, it literally felt like the world was ending. And this is such an obvious thing, but it was so, again, felt kind of so crazy at the time. It was really early and the sun was coming up. And I was like, it's so crazy that the sun just keeps coming up no matter what's going on. And then I felt almost like embarrassed because I was like, the sun doesn't care that like, you have to work from home for 2 years. Like the world goes on. And it kind of made me feel sort of better in a way. Like it made me laugh at myself. And just, I think sometimes feeling small can be comforting in itself.
Yeah. I think humor as a coping mechanism is really interesting. And it's an interesting phenomenon that I've seen. I think the growth of meme or the meme or life is a meme is a very interesting one, because I think that dark sense of comedy for the sense of abyss and filling it with humor is something that I love and I cherish. And I think it's really funny. Like I love sort of dark, meaningless memes. I find them hilarious. I send this to my family and they're like, why are you sending this to us?
I would say nihilist meme culture was like a real victory and like a real discovery when I was writing this book. There is some great like meme nihilist accounts out there. But again, it's like, yeah, it's funny because this stuff, when you actually think about, I mean, it's a very like Sartre way of, you know, you think about like the absurdism of life. What he has that example where he's like, you know, you sit at a table and you're like, I'm crouched under a dead tree, like eating a dead cow, wearing like sort of spun cotton or whatever. When you break these things down, it's like, it is absurd. Everything is insane and funny. And I think when you start looking at it like that, yes, again, it can be kind of confronting, but I also find it kind of liberating because you're just like, oh my God, actually, who cares? Like all of this stuff that we tell ourselves is just like this big collective delusion we're just choosing to participate in.
Yeah, and I get that. I know we talked about it earlier when we said like scrolling through like TikTok or whatever, and sometimes you sit there and sometimes I'm scrolling through it and I think to myself, I feel like you get this moment where you're scrolling, and this could be for anything that you're doing, and you're sort of scrolling through, death scrolling, and you think to yourself, I feel like a monkey in a cage right now, because if you gave a monkey this, what would a monkey do? It would just sort of figure out how to do it. And I just had this realization a couple of weeks ago and I just sort of put my phone away.
Yeah. I mean, it's the rat with the pellet in the cage kind of thing. I mean, this is such a classic, like it's the drone office workers like dilemma. But whenever I have worked in like marketing or like PR or strategy or these things, and you kind of find yourself in these conversations that are like in some ways very interesting and make a lot of sense and are very directly relatable to the world and the things you see in the world and the ways you think about your world. But then sometimes you just like have these moments where you're like, what are we talking about? Like I think it was probably a marketing meeting once I kind of walked out of it and I just said to my boss, I was like, if we all stopped having these meetings and having this conversation, this thing wouldn't exist anymore. like it would just evaporate. It's not real. And I think, you know, everyone's like, yeah, well, true, and keeps going. And I'm not saying that means you have to go quit your job and sit in the desert, but I think it is, there is value in having these moments when you're just like, this thing only exists because, I mean, it's the emperor's new clothes. These things only exist because we allow them to exist.
Yeah, they're socially existed problems. They're socially created problems. Like we have created these problems for ourselves, and then we live within the confines of the things that we've created. Like meetings exactly. is one of those things. It's like, we don't have to have these. Like, who said that we have to have these? And yeah, okay, we have to have them. But it's like, why do they have to be in our... Like, one of the first things that made me quit my first job was ridiculously long meetings for no reason. For no reason. Like, you would end an hour and a half meeting and you thought to yourself, this could have been 5 minutes because people spend the whole time talking about their kids. I don't care about your kids.
Exactly. You don't have to be a nihilist, but you can ask, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
I often say to my friends, like, whenever I'm in one of these situations, sometimes I just look at, like, my partner or a mate, and I'm just like, do you ever feel like maybe we've evolved a little bit too far? Like, maybe we just need to, like, cognitively take, like, 3 steps back. Like, sometimes I feel like that when you talk about philosophy. And, I mean, obviously these are the things I love talking about the most. But you're just like, but, like, what if, maybe we should just actually go back and, like, till the fields a little bit.
Well, I do think a move back to environmentalism is a sort of step back in a way, because it's people being more responsible for their own individual food, eating more locally, you know, reducing their waste, reducing their plastics, all this type of stuff. I do think it's sort of a move back, but a move forward, because there's obviously a growth in technologies enabling that. So I do think that it's a more of a retraction to a life previous.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I work for a publication now that is very interested in sustainability, and we talk a lot about these, like, alternative lifestyles. And there's a pleasure in this stuff takes a lot of time. And yes, at first it's kind of annoying when you have to, like, tend to your bokashi bin or whatever. But then I think, again, when we think of our grandparents or our great-grandparents or our great-great-grandparents, they... Like, life, just being alive took a lot of time. Again, I just said you shouldn't idealize the past, but I guess there are some things we could learn. But I think that this kind of, like, mindless emptiness, my brother used to say when I was a kid, I liked mindless busy work. There is, like, enormous value in it when you have to churn your butter or you have to bake your own cakes or you have to do your own things. I'm not saying we should all become Luddites, but again, it's getting back to that idea of it's okay to just have empty time. And I mean, I'm conscious I'm saying this stuff and I don't do it. I was staying in an Airbnb by myself the other day and I was doing the dishes, and usually at home I would have a podcast on or I'd be watching something on YouTube. I am, like, a binge consumer of media to the point of kind of almost, like, ridiculousness. And I was just doing the dishes and I had this moment where I was like, oh, this is so nice. This is so quiet. This is such, like, a gentle pleasure.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is actually insane that this is something that I don't do in my own life. I would always be, like, somehow making this, like, a, you know, a valuable moment by using this time productively, by multitasking.
So funny you said that, Wendy, because my brother and I had a conversation recently, and we were both, you know, my brother's sort of, he's 30 this year and I'm 28. And I said to him, we were having a discussion about washing the dishes by hand. And we said, it is possibly the most relaxing thing that you can possibly do. And we both looked at each other and were like, oh my God, we're so old now.
I know. I feel like I'm falling into the trap I talk about in my book where it's like, it's just washing the dishes. But I'm kind of like, it's actually this really mindful task where it's a point of reflection and blah, blah, blah. It's like, it's just washing the dishes.
But I think it's interesting, though, that you sort of had that feeling, because I think that is one of those things where people are trying to, you know, attribute meaning to washing the dishes. It's still washing the dishes, but you're still cognizant of the feelings that you had doing it. You know, you're maybe not attributing meaning to it, but you're still getting the benefits from it. And that's perhaps the crux of my interpretation of nihilism. It's like, okay, you're not attributing meaning from everything, but there's still value that you get from doing the things that you do. It's just other people attribute meaning to the things that they're getting benefit or things that are bad. But nihilism,
yeah, that's exactly how I feel. Sometimes it actually unlocks, like, the pure pleasure in the moment of something.
For its own sake?
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I mean, it's a form of mindfulness as well. It allows you to be completely present in something and enjoy it for what it is and not kind of start drowning in all the like possibilities of what it could be.
Where does that fit in with this idea of delayed gratification? Because it's one of those things, like I've read a lot about delayed gratification and the benefits to the self for delaying gratification in the present for a future benefit. And like we've just discussed, this idea of nihilism is trying to remove everything to the present. So do you feel like then they're not conducive to one another, sort of delayed gratification and nihilism?
I mean, to be honest, I haven't really thought that much about it. I would say, I mean, I'm sure delayed gratification is great. I don't have any fundamental issues with it. I would say my interest in nihilism is, I think, how much it does bring you in the present. Because, I mean, I read something once where they said, I mean, there's nothing like misquoting a fact you half remember on a podcast from another podcast. But, you know, there's this, someone said, we spend like 80% of our conscious life thinking about the past, thinking about things that have happened or thinking about things that could happen or about to happen. And that's just always really struck. I think it might've been an Albert Brooks quote, but it's like, that has really struck me of we live our whole lives, but we actually spend so little time in our lives. We're like so trapped in the past and the future.
That's such a good point, because I feel that especially when observing people who are thinking about, you know, things they're planning, and I fall into this, like I always try and plan ahead and I'm thinking about, okay, what new projects am I doing, but also look to the past to try and, you know, find things that I might have not done well at and create a plan from the past and then look into the future and try and create another one. I think to myself, dude, just enjoy what you're doing right now. Like, why are you so fixated on, because at the end of the day, like a plan is a plan. It's not it's not what's actually going to happen. Like things are going to come up that you never even thought are going to come up. So don't spend so much time thinking about it. Just do what you can do right now.
Yeah. It's really, really hard to do. Like I feel it's funny, you almost have to make like a game plan to be in the moment. Like you have to be like, I'm going to go for a walk without my phone, or I'm going to go for a drive and not put music on, or I'm, you know, I'm going to leave my headphones at work or whatever. It's funny. This is kind of not that related to nihilism, but it's maybe just more me. The things I have learned about myself in the past couple of years of thinking about these things. I'm actually like really, really, I love planning. I love short-term planning. I can pretty much tell you what everything I want to eat for dinner next week. But I almost have this, it's probably the closest I have to a belief system. Maybe it's more of a superstition. I really truly believe if you plan something long-term in your life, it will either not come true or it will fuck out. And I think it's because you either get so invested in it that you jinx it, even if that's not real, jinx don't count. But it's like you build it up to the point that you can never really enjoy it because you've set such a precedent for it, that it will always be a disappointment or it'll be confusing or destabilizing because it's not fitting your own fantasy of the future. And when I think about my life, the things that have actually been like really transformative and rewarding and amazing, you know, like great jobs, great relationships, the opportunity to write this book, they've always been things that have completely come out of nowhere. And I think have not only been valuable because I didn't have any expectations for them, so I could probably actually enjoy them for what they were. But also they need to sort of be exciting enough to pull me away from what I thought it was going to do. So they have to be sort of exceptional. And I know it's something that comes up a lot, and I struggle in job interviews sometimes because people say, you know, where do you see yourself in a year or 5 years time or whatever? And I'm just like, I just really consciously try not to think about that stuff because I almost, again, to the point of becoming superstitious, that if I want something, I almost try not to think about it too much because I feel like I'm going to ruin it by pre-living it in my own head.
That's interesting. I've never heard anyone with that perspective where you think about something, because like we've talked about earlier with manifestation, people believe that the more you think about something, the more it's going to happen, but you believe the opposite.
Yeah, it's funny. I was on a work trip the other day and everyone was talking about manifesting and I was like, no, don't do it. It's bad luck. And, you know, people keep saying, you know, with this book, they're like, do you want to write another one? What's next? Blah, blah, blah. And there's part of me that's like, I kind of don't want to think about it too much. I feel like if I think about it, I'm going to kill it. I want to rather just be open to like whatever cool opportunity comes up next that I can kind of like free will my way through, because it's served me pretty well so far.
I mean, to me, when I hear that from what you're saying, to me, it's like an expectation thing. It's like, I don't want to expect too much because I will get burnt. and I don't want to have that feeling.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we've all been there.
Yeah, I mean, what do they say? Expect the worst, prepare for the best. I mean, prepare for the worst, expect the best. I mean, I suppose it's kind of like a bit of a scrambled eggs version of that.
Yeah, a bit of a cliched version of that. Enjoy the journey. I think that is the takeaway from that. Enjoy the journey.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. There's an affirmation you can.
Yeah, exactly. Just say that to yourself. Put it in your journal. Put it on a post-it note on your mirror. Say it to yourself as you beat your chest in the morning.
Exactly. Put it in my app.
Exactly. Just to sort of round off the conversation, I think we've been talking a lot about the elements of nihilism and how it applies to sort of modern day life. But what would your advice be for anyone, you know, our age demographic is 18 to 34. So it's very much, you know, in this space of people who are, you know, new to a job or just finished studies, or they've been in the working world for sort of 10 or so years. And they might be having these questions of, you know, I've been told these things by teachers and my parents and they're crumbling in my hands. So what would your advice be for anyone who's trying to find value through this perspective of sunny nihilism?
Something I think about a lot, and I think we've obviously spoken about a lot here, is yes, this question of what are people trying to get out of me when they're giving me advice or they're kind of telling me what my life should look like, but also to really ask yourself, why do I feel this way and how do I want to feel? Because something that I think I kind of have experienced through this, through nihilism, when you start really deconstructing the way you live and the way you think, is when you really get down to it and you ask, okay, what do I actually want? Like, what I often say, you know, I said I don't really plan things in advance. I don't really have a 5-year plan, but I do have a sense of how I want to feel in the future, like whether that is free or safe or happy or excited or whatever. And I think when you can kind of like isolate how you want your life to feel as opposed to how you want it to look, and you can be kind of guided by that, not only do I think it makes you less susceptible to kind of fall for other people's bullshit messages, but I think the answers to how you actually want to live and behave are a lot simpler than what you might have thought. You know, I'm a real Epicurean. I really seek pleasure and happiness and joy and a sense of like lightness and freedom. And I think for a long time, I thought I needed a lot of money and a lot of power and a lot of control to feel like that. Whereas the reality is, to feel like that, I mean, just like walk the extra block to the good fruit shop to buy a really decent peach. Or I work 4 days a week now and I have less cash because I like having empty time where I can just spend it my own way. I think you have a lot more control to access the things you actually want when you stop kind of listening to all these messages of how to access the things that everyone's telling you you need.
I love that point. And I love the point that you said about this idea that, you know, don't fixate on accomplishments, but a feeling of who you want to be or how you want to be or your state of being. That's probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's all our life is. It's just how you feel day to day. Like, exactly. No one's going to remember it anyway. So you may as well just enjoy it as much as you can.
That goes back to our point. But I think it's true, because we all think about, you know, in the future, we're going to have this feeling and a day is going to come where it all kind of clicks. But the thing that I think about in that is, okay, you might have thought that 5 years ago, but you don't think about that now. So you're just chasing something that's never going to happen.
Again, and it's the idea of you live in the future or you live in the past, where it's like, what do they say? Like, how you live today is how you live your life.
Yeah.
Like, your life is just made up of a lot of Mondays. Because you're not really reaching some like mythical point. It's like you're in it right now. So you can choose to take a deep breath and like have a nice peach or not.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like it's definitely the case. Like, even if, for instance, you know, you're going through a tough time or whatever it might be, like everyone's going through their own thing. You know, we're talking about, you know, death of loved ones, but you were saying about walking down the street. Chances are most people that you've walking past are going through some type of really, really terrible thing, if you just knew. And everyone is, and they're all carrying something, most people. There are some few individuals that don't, but I think being aware of that is also great perspective shift, because then you don't feel like sort of the world is on your shoulders. You think to yourself, yeah, there's 8 billion other people and they're probably going through some crap right now. And you also, you know, you develop some sort of feeling of empathy and all that type of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. What if it's the opposite of main character energy? When you realize you're not the center of things, you actually feel alone.
Oh, interesting. I haven't heard that term before. Main character energy.
Oh, really? You can tell you've taken a break from TikTok as a real thing for a while.
I don't think I was ever on it though, Wendy, if I'm going to be honest. Like, literally, I just posted stuff and ran for the hills. I don't consume things. Because similar to you, is I feel like I've got to a space where I really know what I like and dislike. And I felt like in the past, I used to get anxious because I was seeing how what other people were doing or saying and felt like I had to live up to that. And it wasn't conscious. It was like, they're like subconscious messages. So you're doing something and you think to yourself, oh, well, that person's doing that, but they seem like they're really happy and they're doing really well. So why shouldn't I be doing that? Shouldn't I be investing all my money into Bitcoin? Like, isn't that like the thing to do? And then I thought to myself, once you turn that off, you become, I wouldn't say happier, that's probably not the right word, but the monotony of doing the thing that you want to do becomes enjoyable.
Yeah, exactly. And it's that thing we were saying as well. It's like everyone is searching for someone to tell them how to live a good life. But it's like no one knows what makes you happy more than you. It's probably just not this, as sexy as some of this, like the things people are putting on the internet. Like, what makes me happy? I like watching TV on the couch with my dog. Like, no one's going to make a movie about that. But it's like, that's really the answer there. You don't need to sit, like, search that much harder.
Yeah, I think, and it's also speaking, like, I love speaking to old people and asking them about, like, what they would do differently or just asking about their thought process. And obviously that's sort of perspective is like anyone older than you can ask them. And then you'll quickly come to realize that no one has it figured out and no one ever will have it figured out. So it's kind of up to you to decide what makes you happy in your direction because no one has the answer.
Exactly. That I would say hopefully is my takeaway from all of this.
Definitely. I agree with you. Anyway, Wendy, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast to discuss your book, The Sunny Nihilist. I have it right here. Where's the best place for individuals to find you, whether they be on social media, website, TikTok even maybe?
I think I wouldn't find me on TikTok. I'm sure it'd be pretty grim, whatever's up there. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Wendy Wens, which is definitely when you decide to an internet name when you're a teenager and you never get rid of it. Or WendyCypherIt.com is my website where you can kind of like find all my bits and pieces.
Perfect. I'll put the links in the description below so they can come check you out, ask any questions about nihilism or anything like that. Anyway, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Hopefully you found something to think about at the end of this podcast, and perhaps there was some food for thought for some further research on nihilism as well. If you'd like to check out Wendy's website or purchase the book, the links are in the description below that you can check out as well. If you haven't subscribed as well to the channel, please do. Every single week we release a podcast with an author where we discuss the ideas and principles inside of their book. We have some amazing guests scheduled for 2022, so please do subscribe to make sure you don't miss out on any of those episodes that are going to be coming out. Once again, thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and I'll see you in the next one.